From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
Joining us on the program this week, we have from the Monroe County Intermediate School District, Assistant Superintendent for Special Education and Early Childhood Services, Rachel Kopke. We have the Early Childhood Director, Katie Borbina, and the Head Start and Early Head Start Director, Nicole Van Dale. Also joining us will be Marla Ottebacher, the Administrator for State and Federal Programs from Warren Consolidated Schools. We'll be looking at the role the U.S. Department of Education plays in the lives of millions of school children. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Rachel Kopke, the Assistant Superintendent for Special Education and Early Childhood Services at the Monroe Intermediate School District. Also joining her is Katie Borbina, the Early Childhood Director, and Nicole Van Dale, the Head Start and Early Head Start Director. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
So, Rachel, the focus of this segment is to talk about Head Start and what that means for young children and a lot of the mechanics that go into it. And I think a good place to start would be, could you give us just a good overview of the Monroe County Intermediate School District's Head Start program and its overall mission?
Sure. Head Start's mission is truly to promote the school readiness of children from low-income families, and we provide comprehensive services, including early learning, health, and family well-being, and we actively engage parents in their children's development. We run 16 classrooms, and we're providing services and educational support to 240 children countywide, as well as 48 families within our Early Head Start program.
Rachel, could you share with us also how the program is funded?
We're a federally funded program through the Office of Head Start and the Department of Health and Human Services.
So this question for Nicole, Early Head Start Director. Nicole, can you share with us how the U.S. Department of Education supports and or funds programs like Head Start?
Yes. The U.S. Department of Education, Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Health and Human Services funds the Head Start program fully. And right now, that is a challenge because we are trying to plan without certainty. We are not new to planning without full certainty surrounding funding. However, the current state of the federal government, as portrayed through the media, has exacerbated this uncertainty for both families, staff, potential new employees. Families are worried we're not going to be here for them. Staff are worried for their livelihood. New employees are hesitant to take positions. This is a new challenge for us. However, to combat this uncertainty, we continue to educate ourselves on federal updates and share that information with transparency. Nationally, Head Start has systematically built in strong and united advocacy within the program. This advocacy really has assisted Head Start in being alive and well for over 60 years. So historically, the program has had the bipartisan support needed to remain not only in place, but effective for this long. Mm-hmm. Knowing and being able to share this provides the peace everyone needs to keep doing our good work that we do every day, even with all the noise in the background.
So a question for Nicole Van Dale, Head Start and Early Head Start Director. Nicole, how does the Head Start program support children's social, emotional, and cognitive development?
The program definitely takes a look at the whole child and the whole family and their approach. We look at that in everything we do because we know that in order to support a child's overall development, their basic needs must be met. things like access to food, clothing, shelter, medical or dental care, safe and nurturing homes, etc. Because of this knowledge that we have, the program works to ensure their basic needs are met while simultaneously using an evidence, research, and play-based curriculum that supports children's learning in all areas of development.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask a question. You mentioned something about play-based. Could you give our School Talks listeners an example of something that would be considered play-based as far as their instruction?
Play-based learning consists of different learning centers within the classroom where kids are learning the curriculum and things about standards through their play versus rote direction or memorization of skills, things like that. So they are being exposed to their curriculum through play.
We're currently with Rachel Kopke, Katie Borbina, and Nicole Van Dale from the Monroe County Intermediate School District, talking about the Head Start program. A question for Katie Borbina, the Early Childhood Director. Katie, what impact, in your experience, has the Head Start program had on the local community in Monroe County?
I think one of the largest impacts that Head Start has on the local community is that work that we do to empower families to support their children. So by supporting the entire family, we're helping them to meet their own family goals, you know, related to education, employment, housing, transportation, and overall family well-being. So I think having healthier families leads to having healthier communities, right? Mm-hmm. I also think that being the first step on a family's educational journey, we have a real opportunity to help families build a positive relationship with the school system in general and to support that transition into the local school district when they move on from our program.
Let me ask you, Katie, as a follow-up, how does the enrollment process work and what steps are taken to ensure families are aware of the program's availability?
So at the Monroe County ISD, we operate a number of early childhood programs in addition to Head Start, and we've worked very hard to build a single point of entry for all families. So whether a family is looking for Head Start or home visiting services or an evaluation for their young child, there's one phone number, one call to make, or there's one form to submit on our website, and then we work together as an early childhood team to make sure that that gets to the right location. So when we receive a referral for Head Start, a family is then immediately connected with one of our family partnership specialists who walks them through the entire enrollment process, start to finish, mm-hmm. and really helps them to get familiar with our program, collects all the documentation needed, and make sure that they get to where they need to be. We mm-hmm. have a number of open enrollment events throughout the community, too, so we know that it's not always convenient for families to get to one spot, so we try to make sure that we're hitting local school districts, community centers, public libraries, and enrolling families at those spots that are easier for them to get to. We also keep a really active presence on social media. We know that's where families are looking for information about enrollment, so we're sharing information there frequently. And we are at community events. You know, we know where families might be in the community, and we make sure that we're in those same places to try to get information to them.
Question for Nicole. Given how the families are supported through this process, it raises the question of what are the eligibility requirements for children to actually participate in the Head Start program?
Our program is definitely designed to and required to serve students and families who are experiencing homelessness, for those children who might be in foster care, families who are receiving various types of cash assistance, such as SSI for Disability, DHHS cash assistance, or SNAP, which is commonly known as food stamps, and for families who might be living at or below the federal poverty level. The families living in one or more of these categories or areas are considered to be income eligible for our program. In addition, we use what's called a selection criteria to help us prioritize families based on additional risk factors to the child. The risk factors included in the selection criteria are updated every year, and they reflect what's going on in our community at the time. Examples of different risk factors might be substance abuses in the home, teenage parenting, parents with less than a high school diploma or GED, mental illness present in the home, or a student with a diagnosed disability. All of those factors go into place when considering eligibility.
So we need to take a short break, but when we come back, I'd like to continue this conversation about how we help teachers work with and address such a diverse group of students in the Head Start program. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins & Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
We're back here with the experts from Monroe County, Rachel Kopke, Katie Borbina, and Nicole Van Dale, talking about the Head Start program. And just before the break, we were talking about the diverse population of children who come to this program, and it makes me appreciate what types of training or readiness do teachers need to address such a diverse population. A question for Katie Borbina, given all these factors and issues, how are teachers and staff trained to support the needs of children from such a wide range of backgrounds that they bring to school with them each day?
Professional learning and professional development is a really high priority for us. We recognize the importance of individualized coaching for teachers, so every Head Start team has their own coach that's assigned to support them with their individual learning needs around all those needs that their children might have. There's also a high level of collaboration and support with our special education team at the ISD. One of the benefits, I think, of having special education and Head Start under the same roof is that our Head Start teams have really easy access to special education consultants like social workers, teacher consultants, speech therapists, and they can help guide them about the best way to support students with disabilities and students with differing learning needs. We also provide something really important called reflective supervision for staff. We know that burnout rates in educational settings can be really high, right? We work with a lot of children and families with really complex needs. And so reflective supervision is really a time where staff can be thinking about and working through their own emotional responses to the sometimes heavy work that they're doing, and then processing those emotions with a trained professional so that it doesn't impact their work with students and families.
So a question for Rachel. What role do, when I think about this from a sort of a global perspective, what role do families play in the success of the Head Start program? And how is family engagement, given it seems like a lot of this is support for the entire family, how is that type of engagement encouraged?
You are 100% correct there. Family support and engagement is critical to the success of our programs, and it's something that we really highlight and foster. We hold policy council meetings monthly where we bring together families with some of our staff members. Oftentimes a board member will even participate on that if something is appropriate to do so. We develop family goals with caretakers and the family. We know that when kids walk through our door, we're embracing the whole child, which includes the whole family as well. It's not just who we have access to during the school hours and during the school day. It truly is a whole child approach. Both Katie and I have referenced the family partnership specialist position that really works shoulder to shoulder or hand in hand to support families. This is a critical piece of the program. We employ a positive solutions for families curriculum at every single one of our parent meetings. We have mental health supports for families. And I think one of the really unique things about Head Start, too, is that we work hard to encourage parents or caregivers or other family members to apply for positions when their kids are actively enrolled in our programs. And we've had a lot of success in retaining and recruiting staff members because their kids are active in our programs. We also offer tons of community events and family activities throughout different locations in the county. We know, I think it was referenced earlier, we have to meet families where they're at. And so when we're providing these community events, it's here either at the ISD or it's at a local park or a local library or one of our community resource centers. And we're bringing things in to help families then access other supports within the community. So it truly is that connection between school, child, community, and family.
What a fantastic opportunity to provide support where it's needed most. I heard two things. One is the term whole child, which, as I'm sure you all would agree, is a term that's often, I guess I would say it's often overused, but when you see it through the lens of what you're doing, you really and truly are taking care of the whole child, almost taking care of the whole family. And we're currently chatting with the experts from the Monroe County Intermediate School District about the Head Start program operating in their county. And one last question for Rachel or Katie. Can you share any specific success stories of children who have benefited from the Head Start program and where their continued progress is in school?
Yeah, we have a story that we love to share. It's one of our favorites. We had a single dad raising two kids that enrolled within our program. And because his children were actively involved in Head Start, he was able to apply for, be accepted into, and attend a culinary school and obtain employment. So as you referenced, that whole child, because he was able to access our program and our classrooms, he was able to secure and obtain a position to provide for his family. And as a single dad, you know, that's something that he's so proud of. And he's highlighted that in a video for us that we often share with staff and with families. So that's definitely a moment of pride for us, for the program, and for him.
Makes it all worth it. One last question for Early Head Start Director Nicole Van Dale. What are some of the biggest challenges you see the program facing in the future? And what are your plans to try to address them?
We do have some challenges, just like any agency. I would say our number one challenge is typically recruitment and retention of qualified staff. One of the main reasons for this is an ongoing wage gap between early childhood staff and public school teachers. Some ways we have addressed this issue is through advocating at the federal, state, and local levels. We apply ongoing for funds whenever they're available. We have shifted our funding in some ways to support wage increases. And then one of our largest successes in this area was the development of our staff recruitment and retention procedures. Those allowed us to use a variety of incentives for staff, such as providing stipends for staff who are completing coursework toward an associate degree or a bachelor's degree, providing sign-on and retention bonuses, creation of the development of a wage scale. Through all of this, we were also able to change our recruitment strategies for staff. We now utilize what we call open interviewing, and we noticed applicants started applications, but they did not finish them. The potential applicants needed a fast and easy way to learn more about us and what they were applying for before committing to finish a pretty extensive application. Through open interviewing, we were able to give those applicants the information needed and a glimpse into the culture of our program. Within 6 months, we were able to take our average staff vacancies from 33% down to 3%. We were very proud of that, and although that's exciting, we are beginning to see a rise again in staff and staff turnover. Our data is supporting the rise is due to the ongoing wage gaps, of course, still, and then also the unsustainable inflation and the feeling of uncertainty of the future of the Head Start program.
Rachel Kopke, Katie Borbina, and Nicole Van Dale from the Monroe County ISD. I want to thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us into Head Start because you've really helped our listeners understand all of the mechanics that go into operating a Head Start program. And most importantly, not only helping the child, but the entire family. And excuse the pun, but it really and truly does give them a head start on life. And you should be commended for the great work you're doing. So I appreciate your time and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having us.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now in the program is the Administrator of State and Federal Programs for Warren Consolidated Schools, Marla Ottebacher. Welcome to the program, Marla.
Thanks. next, Dr. Livernoy?
So in our continuing look at the Federal Department of Education and a lot of the discussion that's happening around the potential dissolution of it and whatnot, I thought it was important to give our School Talks listeners a sense of what the Department of Education means to a local school system. And in Warren Consolidated Schools, which is one of the state's largest systems, you really touch on a lot of the different components that the U.S. Department of Education supports in a school district. And with that, what federal programs in Warren Consolidated, what federal programs provide direct funding to local districts like Warren Consolidated, and how are they allocated?
Sure. So one of the largest ones that you're going to hear in the news right now, and it's the largest federal program for K-12 education, is Title I. And the reason that we have Title I is that it helps our disadvantaged students, particularly those from low-income families, achieve academic success. And the way that that's allocated is that school districts receive funding based on the amount of low-income students that attend our schools. And it's all based on a formula, and the factors include the percentage of low-income learners that we have, and then the school district's total enrollment. And then how do we use those funds? We use those to help drive our academic achievement. But like, what does that look like in our schools, right? So if you have enough funds, most school districts will use those to hire additional staff, usually with a focus of reading and math. Sometimes it can be used to help provide professional development, but really we use it to help provide programs for those at-risk learners. Things like summer reading programs, parent involvement programs, things like looking at the dangers of social media, girls' empowerment for parents and daughters, our enrichment assemblies. You know, when you're wondering how did we fund, you know, Dan the lizard man at school, you know, it's through Title I, right? Some things that are funded through a PTA at one school may not be afforded at another school. That's Title I.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Scholastic Reading Subscription. All of those things are why we love Title I.
And, you know, given in the state of Michigan, I think childhood poverty hovers around 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And if Title I is meant to support children in poverty, that's a substantial portion of children in public schools in the state. And the way you detailed all of these different opportunities that funding is used for, how does the U.S. Department of Education ensure that the federal money school districts are receiving are being used effectively? What types of measurement tools do they use?
I submit a budget, and each and every single item on that budget is scrutinized, like right down to the date of a conference, right down to the penny of a conference, and I can't go over that. Each one of those items has to align with our MyKit plan. And for those of you that don't know, our MyKit plan is like a school improvement plan, if you will. And all of that drives our academic success. And so everything has to align and be in order and really help our with the focus of our students so that they succeed. And so each district is paired with a consultant through MDE who is highly trained to look for the details to make sure that each budget item is itemized to help students succeed and that it's all in line with each one of those titles and each mm-hmm. one of those grants. And then they're scrutinized. Does this match the intent of the grant or does it not?
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned MyKIP and MDE, and I think it's important for our School Talks listeners to know that when federal money comes to a state, it flows through the state level and the state is responsible for distributing that money. It's sort of a flow through, if I understand that correctly. So,
yes.
In the spirit of initiatives, what types of initiatives does the Department of Ed have in place to support English language learners at the local level? What are some specific examples of that?
So the Department of Ed has two big pots of money that come through us, through Title III and Title III immigrants. So Title III is our English language learners who, if a parent checks a box when they're registering their students that they speak a language other than English at home, then they will qualify for Title III. And then if they are also they'll qualify for Title III immigrants if they have been in this country for 3 years or less. And then those funds will all go towards things like high quality instruction for EL learners, additional teachers, so our kiddos can be pulled out of the classroom and get some additional help, particularly with learning the language, and then, you know, additional curriculum if they need it and supports.
So you mentioned Title III. So we've talked about Title I, Title III. How does the federal government help school districts provide resources and support for students with disabilities?
Oh, that would be under IDEA. And that's another hot topic that you're going to see, you know, all over the press right now. And so that's definitely geared towards, you know, our special ed students. And so that goes to fund things like our school psychologists, our social workers, special individualized programs for kids who need it. And, you know, you're talking about the gamut of learners here. So, you know, our kids who need really, really specific programs and might need to be pulled out, but also for that kiddo who just needs, you know, an individualized education plan, who might just need some specific help in math. You know, some kids who are on 504 plans who just might need extra time to finish an exam. So IDEA funds all of these things, including early childhood learning for kids who need a little bit extra support, that, you know, speech help as well. All falls under IDEA.
Mm-hmm. So we're currently with the Administrator of State and Federal Programs, Marla Ottebacher from Warren Consolidated Schools. Marla, when we come back from the break, I would like to talk to you a little bit more about how the department supports teacher training and helping teachers be ready to serve all of these different populations of students. So if you'll stay right there, we'll be back right after this. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
We're back here with Marla Ottebacher, the Administrator of State and Federal Programs from Warren Consolidated Schools, talking about how the U.S. Department of Education provides funding support to local school districts. And Marla, before the break, we were talking about all of the different title grants and the functions they serve, whether it's students with special needs or English language learners. In a different lens, how does the Department of Education support actual teacher training or professional development to actually work with these types of populations?
That would fall under Title II. So Title II is really focused on the professional development of our teachers and our administrators and growing our leaders. I mean, just like the Detroit Lions have a really strong coaching staff, all, you know, our teachers and our admin need coaching as well. So we receive funds for PD, for our educators, whether it's mentoring, whether it's specific curriculum-based content instruction, all of that falls under Title II.
Mm-hmm. And in a similar lens, what resources or programs exist or are available for teachers to address the ever-increasing focus on mental health and student well-being in schools? Where does that fit in this puzzle?
So under Title IV, there is a component of student mental health and well-being. In fact, 20% of that title has to be spent on mental health and well-being. And there are specific programs that you can reach out to your ISD. And I'm going to be honest, we can never find enough programs that have to do with student mental health. There are never enough. We're always focused on things like anti-bullying, you know, reaching out to our counselors and our mental health providers to help mm-hmm. us through that. You know, another component of that title in general is just helping kids feel like they belong to school. Things like art and foreign language, and when they come to school, having them feel like they're part of the classroom and seeing themselves at school and wanting to just be there and feel safe in their building.
And, you know, an unfortunate byproduct of the school violence that we've experienced in the last 20 years is the profile of the student who does not feel connected at school.
Mm-hmm.
And running alongside that, we've known for years that students who feel connected at school always do better academically and socially. And it really points to all of the things that wrap around your traditional education, like extracurricular activities and, you know, different clubs after school and things. And when you provide that opportunity for them to feel connected, it really and truly positions them to do much better in school. And in this day and age, with so many students consumed with their cell phones, they've actually become detached from the school culture. I can distinctly remember seeing a picture one time. It's probably, 12 or 15 students who are sitting on a bench in one of the world's most famous art museums with these giant paintings, right? And none of them are looking at the paintings. They're all seated looking at their phones. So there's this interesting connection between driving more support to mental health, because kids are so consumed with cyberbullying and phones and Snapchat and all that, when in reality, there is a plethora of opportunities for them to feel connected at school. And this connection between the support that the Department of Education provides and driving it into schools, I think, is an important one. I also want to mention one other thing. You touched on it. One of the great challenges schools have faced in the last few years is the availability of people to provide mental health support in the school setting. Mm-hmm. I've talked to more educators about receiving money from the federal government or from the state and whatnot, but they're just aren't enough people to do that kind of work. And that really creates a disconnect between I have all this money but nowhere to spend it. And you try to get creative with programs on bullying and whatnot. So we're currently here with Marla Ottebacher, the Administrator of State and Federal Programs for Warren Consolidated Schools. Marla, one other question in sort of a similar lens. How does the Department of Education assist schools in implementing STEM and career readiness programs?
So we receive CTE grants from the Perkins grant. Some of that money is spent on direct programs, direct vocational programs, but it can also be spent on certificates. So you'll see kids getting their welding certificates, their electronic certificates as well. Some of that money can also be spent back to that Title IV I talked about previously on STEM programs. We also get robotics grants as well. The DOE is big on funding our students and their programs through STEM. It's also on how you creatively want to spend your funds and on how you write your grants and if you can support it through that MyKit program that we talked about earlier.
Yep. And you know, a really important distinction right now is the amount of support the federal government provides states. When you look at the list of things you've detailed for us, really touches many, many students, far beyond just Title I or whatnot. And I've always been intrigued by their use of numbers, Title I, because I think we've touched on all of them, Title I, Title II, Title III, Title IV. On previous editions of this program, talked about Title IX. Mm-hmm. So all of these numbers attached to different, very specific and focused areas of support for public schools. So one last question in the spirit of titles and numbers. Does the federal government provide any specific support financially for districts who are seeking innovation and practice in technology integration in schools? Is there any particular grant or title number that goes for tech integration?
Title IV, a portion of that, so 20% of that has to be spent on wellness, and 20% of that has to be spent on the mental health piece, and then a portion, whatever portion you want, must be spent on technology as well.
So in the mix of all of these different title things, when you think about the conversation over the U.S. Department of Education, I think it's really important that we look at it through two different lenses. One, what is the structure of the department? And two, all of the available funding that's coming to states, touching on just about every walk of life in a public school. It's not just students in poverty. You have career tech programs. You have, one area that blankets all children is mental health and well-being.
So, absolutely.
Marla Ottebacher, Administrator of State and Federal Programs for Warren Consolidated Schools, I appreciate your time today, and especially a look at how the U.S. Department of Education funds schools and what actually happens at the local level. I appreciate it very much, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As we close out today's program, I want to take a few moments and recap some of the discussion we had about the U.S. Department of Education and the kinds of support it provides to states and children in schools. While many people may think of it as just another government agency, its role in supporting underprivileged children, training educators, and ensuring access to quality education is vital to the success of millions of students across the country. The Department of Ed plays a crucial role in leveling the playing field for students who come from low-income backgrounds, minority communities, and underserved areas. And I can tell you, in my experience as a superintendent, one of the most debilitating forces in a child's life is coming from poverty. And programs like Title I of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act provide billions of dollars in funding to schools that serve these disadvantaged students. These funds help reduce class sizes, improve instructional quality, and provide additional academic support through tutoring and after-school programs. And let's not forget about students with disabilities. The Department of Education administers the Individuals with Disabilities Act, as what we know as IDEA, ensuring that children with special needs receive appropriate accommodations, tailored learning plans, and the support they need to thrive in the classroom. As we've said and we've heard for many years, no child should be left behind due to circumstances beyond their control. And this commitment to inclusivity ensures that every student, regardless of ability, has a fair chance at success. Lastly, the Department of Education ensures accountability in our education system through programs that track student performance, evaluate school effectiveness, and enforce civil rights protections. The department helps ensure that no community is ignored and that every student receives a high-quality education. Schools that struggle can receive funding and resources for improvement, ensuring that students aren't left behind due to systemic issues. And in essence, the U.S. Department of Education isn't just an administrative body, it is a virtual lifeline for millions of students and educators across the country. And from funding low-income schools, to providing grants for aspiring teachers, to supporting special education programs, to ensuring access to higher education, its work is essential to shaping the future for millions of students. And as we know well, and we've talked many times here on School Talks, when we invest in education, we invest in the future of our country. We invest in innovation, progress, and a workforce prepared for the challenges of tomorrow. And whether we like it or not, that tomorrow is coming. And that's why the role of the U.S. Department of Education is such a factor in the education and support for students and their families. And not only just for today's students, but for the generations that will follow. That's all the time we have for today, but I would like to thank our guests, Rachel Kopke, Katie Borbina, and Nicole Van Dale from the Monroe County Intermediate School District, and from Warren Consolidated Schools, the Administrator of State and Federal Programs, Marla Ottebacher. That's all the time we have for now, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.